The Mad Tech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by Exchange Wire.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Exchange Wire Mad Tech Podcast. I'm your host this week, Anne-Marie Sheedy, CRO at Exchange Wire. And I've got two fantastic guests joining me this week. Firstly, allow me to introduce you to George Odysseus, CCO from Planet Sports. Hello, George.
Hi, Anne-Marie. Pleased to be here.
Excellent. And the one and only Matt Broughton, Research Leader at Exchange Wire. Hello, Matt.
Hi, Anne-Marie. Pleasure to be here as always.
Excellent. And I'm delighted that we've got people here in the office. It's always good to have it in person. So I'm going to crack on with our three stories. The first one, which is from Social Media Today, and it's about X announces exclusive content deal with the WWE. So, and that's the World Wrestling Entertainment Organization. They have said that from April, their partnership will see the launch of WWE Speed, a new weekly video series which will showcase timed WWE matches exclusive to the platform. I believe this weekly video series will consist of about 5 minute length matches described as fast paced, action packed face offs, and will star WWE household names. No idea who they would be, but I'm not a fan. Apparently, they plan on releasing new episodes 52 weeks of the year. That's a fair bit of content to keep them busy. Right, George, I'd like to come to you first. How do you think X's move towards video content is playing out so far?
It's a well-trodden path. This is nothing new that... I still call them Twitter, by the way.
You know, they'll
always be Twitter to me. Sorry, Elon. But it's a well-trodden path. You know, they've done, with rights... broadcast around the NFL, you know, they've done deals with the likes of Paris Hilton and Tucker Carlson. And I can sort of understand that content exclusivity as a means of attracting users to the platform. But, you know, I can't help but think, is this, you know, Twitter's issue when it comes to attracting premium ad spend? You know, the monthly active users were, I believe, are up, whether that's, you know, in response to the situation in the Middle East and the Ukraine with a lot more interest. But it's not attracting users. It's making it attractive for advertisers. And it's, you know, and video content, it could be great. You know, it has the platform, it has the reach. It's present on a lot of millions of devices around the world. And it's you know, easy access content. What is their motive behind it? Is it to try and attract a demographic of user that they don't have?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it to try and increase the credibility, attract advertisers back onto the platform? But I think if it's the latter, I do feel that they need to address two. It's, you know, I liked, you know, Twitter.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's great. You know, I use it for my news source. If I need to, you know, I saw a terrible headline around the shooter at the Kansas City fan celebration. And Twitter's my go-to to try and see what was going on. You know, I don't go to Sky News, BBC. I go to Twitter and sort of get, scroll through. But on the whole, I think it can be a very toxic environment. I can see why brands don't want to be associated with toxic content, you know, and...
Tough to control.
Since Elon Musk came in, he certainly lowered that bar in terms of
what's offensive.
And, you know, and I'm...
Kicked the bar off the stands and left it on the floor.
Yeah, something like that. You know, I think we can all sit here and say, we're against censorship. But, you know, but there are times when you think, oh, that's a bit too far.
Yeah.
But, you know, because that's personal opinion. You know, we can all believe in free speech until it offends us personally. But I think from an advertiser perspective, it's still it's a risky proposition.
Yep.
I think they never really evolved their ad products. And I think that's the main issue here. Is how
so
do they engage
So they're skipping past that and moving on to video.
Yeah, they're sort of, it's not, I don't say, I don't, for me personally, I don't see, it's not the attractiveness of the platform for users to go on.
Mm.
And yeah, this is another, great, that's another reason if I'm into WWE, I'll, you know, I'll log on and see these matches. Personally, I'm not, you know, I grew up in the era of Giant Haystacks and Big Daddy.
Well, but,
I don't know. I'm old school.
Wasn't Hulk Hogan or something? Is that?
Yeah, he was the original WWE.
That's what I remember.
Yeah, show my age there, Marie. But I think it doesn't detract from. I think the point, they need to appease the advertiser concerns, and you know, I won't repeat what Elon Musk said to some of them who didn't want to be on the platform. It's before the
also he could have just woken up one morning and decided this is the plan from, you know, other decisions. I don't know, Matt, what do you think?
Yeah, so I think in terms of the advertiser, I'm not sure those brand safety concerns that have risen up even more on the platform since Musk took over, I don't think they've been addressed. And I think generally advertisers are quite forgiving, but, you know, obviously look at the kind of brand safety scandals that Facebook's had in the past, and that's currently flying at the moment as a platform. In terms of this video content strategy, it looks like they've found Spotify's COVID era playbook in the bin, in terms of those big content exclusives, and are just, you know, trying to run with that themselves. And I'm not sure that's going to be a real effective long-term strategy if they don't really have those ad products around it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you mentioned Spotify and that, you know, the Joe Rogan podcast, which is leading one in that respect. But that's primarily, I think, a subscription service. I don't have the numbers, you know, between those who have the ad version and those who subscribe, but it's an attracting subscriber.
Yeah.
Unless Twitter, this is the first step in moving down to, like, you know, a subscription-type model, which... Personally, I think for something like that, I think that's the way forward, because I do feel its ad products are not there.
Yeah.
You know? And I think it's, without becoming too onerous on the user, you know, I'm sort of maybe a false equivalence, but you look at YouTube and how they run pre-roll, you know, they can't do that, something like
that.
You know, you can't force someone to watch an ad on Twitter. And I think this is the same thing with TikTok, you know, when you see that, and, you know, advertisers are experimenting with TikTok, etc. But ultimately, you know, how effective are those ads? I'd be interesting to see how that evolves. But
that's a question, actually. I just want to kind of jump in there. I'm curious to kind of get your thoughts, both of you, on, so you've got the rollout of exclusive sports content on there that they're hoping will help bolster their offering. And going back to what you were saying, George, in terms of you're a fan, you know, you consume information and news and Twitter in the format that it is, but are they trying to retain you but push content in front of you that you don't naturally consume in that environment, videos, or are they trying to reach a different audience and try and bring them off the likes of TikTok, where people are demographically, I would say, a lot younger, and that they're used to consuming information in that environment, and they're trying to get a stake of that pie? But how, in God's name, can you feel that WWE content is a natural environment in Twitter? I don't know. It doesn't sit naturally for me.
Absolutely. And I think if you look at it as, you know, if they're looking at it as just a platform where they can reach people, then, and I'll be honest, I've no idea what the demographic is for WWE.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I don't want to make any assumptions. I don't know either.
It's quite wide ranging. Obviously, we discussed it on the podcast in terms of the recent deal they've done with Netflix. And I think that seems a more natural play in terms of, as you say, it's a subscriber-based platform. Obviously, they now have the advertised offering.
It was like in Saudi, there's huge followings. In certain geographical regions, they've got a huge uptake as well. That was quite surprising.
So I think that's where it kind of plays well there. But in terms of the move of X, it's a bit chicken and egg scenario, because the reason WWE fans are fans is because of the existing either weekly content in terms of Raw or, you know, the WrestleMania, those kind of big premium shows. I'm not sure where that 5-minute short burst fits into that, and I would have thought that TKO's other property, UFC, would fit slightly better in that. You know, in terms of just, rather than have big fight nights, have one-off 5-minute bouts. But yeah, I'm not entirely sure how this short play pans out. It may pan out well, and it may be right in terms of that, you know, that TikTokification. They really want that short, digestible content. But equally, if it doesn't really attract the fans, then it may not play out for them, which I think it's probably why WWE's gone for a 2-year deal rather than the decade long deal they've done with Netflix, because it's still a bit unproven at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, look, Netflix don't have live sports rights, that they have to create content around sport, whether, you know, Drive to Survive, which, you know, really elevated Formula One to a new audience. And, you know, it was a proud moment for us at Planet Sport when, you know, Planet F1, one of our flagship sites, was featured
Amazing.
On more than one occasion on there. But we saw the impact of Drive to Survive, the 2019 season, mm-hmm. you know, which, 2021, I get that wrong, where it sort of culminated in Abu Dhabi and the Verstappen and Hamilton race off that day. So,
yeah, the safety car.
You see the benefit of pushing more and more content and getting a new audience. But as I say, is it the purpose? I mean, I can see with Netflix, they're trying to provide more content to keep the subscribers and retain them, attract new ones. But, if, you know, what is Twitter's ultimate goal behind this? I'm not quite clear. So,
you know. And that's the question I'm going to put to try to wrap this discussion up before we move on to the next story. We'll do a poll. Yes, no, maybe. Matt, do you think this, amongst all the other kind of contentious decisions by Elon Musk, is going to attract more advertisers back to Twitter/X?
Maybe, but I'm going to lean more towards no. Okay. Like George said, that kind of strategy seems a bit up in the air at the moment. I think we need that clarity.
No, it wasn't meant to be a one-word answer there.
I like to expand.
Well, if you can't give a one-word answer, nor shall I. No, because I think there's, you know, this is just one tiny aspect of why people go on Twitter, and I think they've got to address their ad products. And you know, I've got friends who work in their sales team. I'm sure they might contact me if they hear this, but yeah.
Well, keep us updated.
But yeah.
Okay, thank you. Right, next story. This is from Wired, and this is where this article talks about Google rebrands its AI chatbot as Gemini to take on ChatGPT. So Google is bringing its ChatGPT-style chatbot Bard and some other key AI features under the banner Gemini. A new, more powerful version of the chatbot, Gemini Advanced, is subscription only. So there's a couple of key takeaways that I kind of want to just share with our listeners before we dig in. This rename is, I don't know, apparently it's available in over 40 languages with the mobile app for Android and iOS devices. A subscription plan for a premium version of the tool called Gemini Advanced, yes. It's available as part of the Google One AI Premium plan for a cool $19.99 per month. And some people are saying that the move could help Google better compete with premium versions of tools offered by the likes of OpenAI's ChatGPT and Microsoft's Copilot. With this in mind, Matt, get your thinking cap on. Is this an admission that Google has kind of fallen behind the likes of Microsoft and OpenAI in the AI race, do you think?
I'm leaning more towards so. It looks as though they've been playing catch up a lot of the time with the likes of OpenAI. We've seen, you know, I'm a PC user. As soon as I log into my PC now, there's a big Copilot button at the bottom of the start bar. Use any of their services, it's all pretty much bundled in. And I think the launch of particularly Bard went down like a, you know, turd down the drain, given how, you know, successful that was in terms of it getting incorrect answers. And to me, it's quite amazing how far Google has fallen behind Microsoft and OpenAI, especially when, you know, the kind of generative AI text services that these platforms offer, they could really overhaul the search market, which is obviously Google's key key playground. And, you know, we saw, you know, late last year, early this year, the executive drama going on at OpenAI, the in-out-shake it all about scenario there. And you'd have thought with that could, you know, really damage a more fledgling product and offering. But they're still going from strength to strength. So it kind of shows how little Google's AI products have fallen into consideration so far.
George, what do you think?
So I think good points there, Matt. Listen, I think it's well acknowledged that Google's AI products are behind ChatGPT. I can only guess as to why. I think Google's revenue is still predominantly search. You know, search, I mean, YouTube. But search is, I mean, they haven't really managed to diversify their principal revenue stream away from search. So an AI and how it can be used with ChatGPT, you know, whether in a ChatGPT or now Gemini type product, is sort of fundamentally changes the way people search and gather information. And you can't help that part of Google we're thinking, look, you know, we'll be cannibalizing our own sort of revenue here. But I will say that, you know, we're very early in AI's
life. Yeah.
You know, and I've been in this, you know, sort of, you know, been in the industry, but, you know, the internet user for what, nearly, well, 27, 28 years now, you know, and Google was a late entrant into search. And look what happened there. So, you know, they've got the resource, they've got the money and they've got the, sort of the brand and the market positioning to be in it for the long haul. They're not, you know, they're not going to run out of cash, let's put it that way. So I do think, you know, that, you know, the move to Gemini, where they, you know, I thought Bard was a, I didn't really, you know, it didn't, I don't think it sort of spoke to me as a brand.
No.
Sorry, Google marketing people, but, you know.
They'll be knocking on your door as well.
But then ChatGPT doesn't really either, right? You know, it doesn't sort of, but you sort of, they had that ability that it was synonymous with AI, was ChatGPT.
Yes, yeah.
And a bit like, you know, someone always referred, like, Google won when to search was to Google, you know. And you know, and I think ChatGPT got the early march there. But it's time. There's time, you know. 100 million monthly users, but, you know, it's a big world out there. So there's a lot more growth that's going to come out and development in this space. So, you know, I wouldn't be writing off any, you know, with Google or any other sort of wannabe who wants to come up. I think we're going to see a lot more development, a lot more sort of small businesses, innovative. You know, and I also think, you know, Google's a, it's a behemoth. You know, it's a huge business. So, you know, then, you know, we know huge businesses don't move at pace. They don't develop. They're not as innovative. And because, you know, a lot more process and bureaucracy. And, you know, and that impacts Google, you know. So everything that made them great in their early days, you know, in their innovations in search.
Well, there you go. I was going to say, I mean, they're not exactly renowned for innovation recently. They're renowned for acquisition. But where's the innovation coming? And that's just wanted to dig a little bit deeper there, if I may, George, in terms of just from, you mentioned as an internet user, but I'm curious to know if there's anything you can share with our listeners in terms of, as a publisher, what's currently being used and what do you think has the potential, really?
So, yeah, look, AI is... been dominating a lot of our internal discussions at Planet Sport as a publisher, and to... In a number of ways. So one, how we use it to improve efficiency within the business. How do we? But two, also how it's become a threat to content creators.
Yeah,
I use the word. No, you can use the word publishers, but I'll call them content creators. And you know, you mentioned how it can impact the search market, and people still use Google for content discoverability. You know, and if those users sort of, and we've seen, you know, we've seen the evolution in the way Google treats, you know, search queries, that quite often it answers the question on the Google page.
Yes.
So negates the need for to click through to a publisher.
Yeah.
So it sort of scrapes the content, lifts the answer, and so the user never has to leave Google. And, you know, you see the same similar trends across the, you know, the likes of Instagram and Facebook, etc. They don't want users to leave their platform. They want to keep them on there. But AI is a learning algorithm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it needs to be fed content. Well, if those content creators aren't being compensated, you know, generally through advertising.
Yes.
How is the AI algorithm going to learn? And I think, you know, you've got two types of content. Let's say more evergreen, you know, where answers don't change day to day, week to week. I think they, you know, they'll be quietly, you know, sort of very worried.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because if answers are being gleaned just by asking ChatGPT or, you know, Google Gemini a question and getting the answer, because it's like it's been scraped off the content creator's website, and, you know, they're going to lose traffic, you know. And I've spoken to a few publishers, and they all see this threat, is that, you know, it's going to negate the need for users to come to their site to get the answers that they need because it's been provided. But it's the answers are coming from those content creators.
Yes, which, Matt, I mean, yeah, that's your bread and butter, really. Yeah. What are your thoughts in terms of, do you feel that your job's at risk? You create this content, your research leads. Where are you at? Are you using it?
Yeah, so basically the way I look at it is it's a tool ultimately, and it can, you know, it can have good and bad effects in terms of it can, you know, bring some great efficiencies. It can really help smaller teams such as ours, mm-hmm, to really punch above our weight in terms of what we can produce. But equally, in terms of that side of things, if you were more of that kind of, you know, that static evergreen content, that kind of long-lasting guide type content, sort of recipes, mm, jumps to mind, then yeah, obviously, if you're not being fairly compensated for that, and these AI platforms are able to go beyond what you get in the SERP results nowadays, in terms of the short snippet answers, and they can give you things like full recipes, full how-to guides, for example, then if they're not being compensated for that, mm, and they don't get any of that referral or click-through traffic, then it's obviously going to be very concerning for them. So I do think more industry-wide and governmental efforts need to be undertaken to ensure what is that compensation model, how does that work in practice, and how can we get everyone working on that same page to make sure that those publishers whose content it fundamentally is, just to make sure they're being paid for it.
Yeah. So, you know, as a publisher, you can block the ChatGPT script.
Yes, yeah.
You know, and we could all, you know, we could all do that. But it's one of those where anyone who's sort of heard me speak before, I'm a strong believer in collaboration, mm-hmm, I think, especially amongst the publishing community, because, you know, we account for 15-20% of the ad spend. You know, 80% goes to, you know, the larger, much larger businesses. So, you know, we should be working together for the collective.
I think you're aware that the Exchange were massively behind the 20%ers.
Yeah, I've heard, you know, I think probably that number's...
We've taken a subtle approach.
It comes from Kieran. I've heard him mention it. Absolutely.
Once or 20% times, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But it's, we should be acting in unison to try and address this. You know, individually, you know, our voices are too, they're not heard. You know, and I know the likes of New York Times, but, you know, again, like, you know, we're talking like, even within the publishing, you've got the big guys, you know, potentially The Reach and the News UKs and, mm-hmm, et cetera, you know, who could sort of demand a seat at the table with Google or ChatGPT,
yes, yep,
and sort of, you know, thrash out a deal. But what about everyone else? And, you know, and I think we'll agree that we need a healthy ecosystem. We need a plurality of content sources, you know. And so, yeah, I do sort of worry about the impact and, you know, on how, you know, with our sites, they're generally sports sites, it's up-to-date news, it's not so evergreen. There's evergreen, yeah, features in there, but we're not generally answering questions, you know, we're providing news. So, but we do see user behaviour changing away from the way people source their content. And so, yeah, it's...
Interesting.
It's a threat. There's always a threat. Yeah. You know, I'll say, you could argue that I can only been a publisher for like 4 or 5 years, and I've been on the other side, like the ad networks, etc. And you never really appreciated the challenges that are thrown at the publishing industry, you know. And
I had to keep the lights on.
Yeah. You know, and it's, you know, you need constant evolution. You need to be constant looking over your shoulder and looking around and how to counter the threats.
Yeah.
And AI is a threat. But again, from an operational perspective, it can bring great efficiencies. You know, we're not using it to create content. I know some publishers are. They're labeling it as such. But, you know, I've seen content that's been created by AI. And yes. It's scarily good. And this is, we're very early in the evolution. So, you know, you do. But again, I think it depends how it's used. You know, thing is, if everyone used the same formula to create content, there's going to be no differentiation. So,
yeah, you know, exactly. And I think if you're literally just using it to spam out lots of content and it's writing the content wholesale for you, then obviously, you know, it can improve, but it's never going to have that almost curated feel that human written content does. And to clarify how we use it, we never write articles using it. It's just a very helpful tool, especially in the early research side of things. Okay, what are the kind of avenues we can explore with it? And then it's kind of building out from there. But yeah, there Absolutely. Are going to be publishers that, you know, want that much quicker turnaround in terms of the articles, and we'll write using AI platforms. But yeah, like I say, it's very good. It's a step above what we've had previously, but it's not there yet in terms of that readable content, at least for me. Please keep your job safe.
And fingers crossed. We don't use ChatGPT to write our stories. Thank you very much. On that note, let's move on to the third story, which is from The Media Leader. And this one is about UK household streaming subs dip despite global surge. Now, the article states that the number of UK households with SVOD subscription video on demand service decreased by 500,000 quarter on quarter, according to Barb's latest data. Now, this is from Barb's establishment survey, which showed 18.8 million UK homes, or for those numbers people out there, 65% of the population, had access to an SVOD service in Q4 2023, compared with 19.3 million, or 67%, in Q3. The analysis found decreases across the board, so that means for Netflix, Amazon Prime Video, Disney Plus, Apple TV Plus, and Sky's Now, with a small increase for Paramount Plus quarter on quarter. This included an estimate for Netflix's advertising tier for the first time. So just for clarity, that apparently is currently sitting at around 1.4 million UK households, which equates to around 5.1% of homes. And these numbers kind of form part of the overall Netflix household subscription figure rather than an addition. George, lots of numbers there. What do you feel is the kind of potential reason for the decrease in the UK compared to other global markets?
I think there's a couple of factors at play. So, you know, macroeconomic factors, I don't think can be ignored here. You know, I mean, I think only this morning we've announced that we're technically in a recession. I think I always say you can sort of get the temperature of the economy just by our own experiences and what we see. And, you know, for many years, living in London, you're almost in a bubble and you sort of don't, you know, we seem to be insulated from wider economic effects. But I think, you know, we've seen it here. You know, we've seen the layoffs in our industry alone. You know, people I know have been affected and like, I think it's never before in my time in this industry have I seen the amount of, you know, sort of layoffs and lack of opportunities especially at senior level.
Yes.
Which affects the sort of higher earners, obviously. So I think they are macroeconomic factors and people are looking to cut back. But I think there's also the plethora of subscription services, whether it's Apple, Amazon, Paramount, Netflix, obviously, Prime. And it's only so much content people can consume.
Yes.
You know, and I think, you know, because of Netflix, you know, I don't know about anyone else, but I can't wait I don't watch episodes weekly.
You know? Oh, binge watching all the way.
We binge watch.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
So if you subscribe, let's say, to Paramount Plus, it's quite quickly you might be able to get through a lot of their content that you're interested in. And you think, you know what, I can pause it for a few months. And then I can come back and I can watch it again. It's not like it's current affairs. It's not like, you know, that content expires in its relevancy. And And I think this is where Netflix has done well, probably, you know, overall numbers, I don't appreciate they might dip or people move into ad-funded, but, you know, they have a constant stream of new content, you know.
They do, but a lot of it's rubbish. A lot of it's, rubbish.
Yeah, pretty crap, yeah, I get that.
Apart from the Six Nation documentary that I'm watching at the moment.
There's enough there to keep you, you know, I might watch that next week or next month. You know, and I think, you know, they've also had early mover advantage, you know, and they were in a lot of homes, you know, and I think a lot of Apple, say the Apple TV, which has got some great programs on it. You know, I'm watching Slow Horses at the moment.
That is fantastic.
Thoroughly recommend. Yeah. And that's on there, but you sort of, you know, they gave away a lot of free 6-month subscriptions, are people then renewing them, etc. But again, I can go back in 3 months' time and I can resubscribe it and I can watch the programs I want to watch. And I think people are, you know, and I think it all boils down that people are a lot more conscious that of their finances. And, you know, and looking to save where they can. And
and there's an element of subscription fatigue. We've talked about it. Yeah. You know, there's,
and how many could you reasonably have?
Exactly. And justify, regardless of your wealth or if circumstances change. Matt, I'm going to maybe put you on the spot here, because I know behind the scenes you've been doing an awful lot of work in this area. And I'm kind of keen to get your viewpoint on other markets as to what's happening.
So I think in terms of how the UK is faring, to echo George, really, it comes back to that macroeconomic climate. You know, we've got high inflation remaining in the UK. GDP per person is part of those figures that were released earlier, you know, late yesterday, early today. GDP per person has been falling for 2 years, whereas other markets have been a little bit more resilient. And I think that's where, in terms of the UK, compared to, you know, maybe the likes of North America and particularly Asia, you know, that subscription fatigue is a little bit more emphasised. I think also as well, in terms of the decline this quarter, there's an element of it being Q4. There's a lot more content readily available on, you know, the broadcaster platforms in terms of the films and movies and TVs, which is maybe why consumers are a little bit more likely, you know what, let's pause it over Christmas. There's
exactly
enough films on.
Seasonal.
I'm going to be seeing, you know, going out, seeing people, travelling, etc. More than I would at any other time of the year. So I don't think we've got to the point of we're now, you know, cord cutting like back in the day with cable TV. But I think, yeah, in terms of how the UK is faring, it's just a little bit more exposed in terms of those macroeconomic factors, which is why we're maybe seeing a little bit more of a dip here. But I don't think it's panic stations, you know, video content. It's you know, where the subscriptions go down, it's an opportunity for the advertisers to come in, and, you know, we've seen already the growth of Netflix's ad offering. And I think that's where, you know, advertising as an industry can help, you know, the film and television side of things. And obviously ultimately help the consumer in time where wallets are a bit more pinched than usual.
Indeed. George, what do you think? I mean, in terms of the potential ramifications for advertisers as a result of this dip versus do we expect to see a kind of corresponding increase in AVOD viewership?
I think, you know, people, you know, if they're financially conscious, they still want to access the content, they'll look at, you know, the ad-funded models that are out there.
Mm.
And, you know, with the decline in linear TV, you know, I don't think that's going to slow down. You know, I look at the younger generation,
Do they even watch TV?
I mean, probably, I think that's the other issue with the subscription. I was sort of going to say is, like, you know, where is the media consumption? You know, is it, you know, is it on YouTube and, you know, TikTok or Instagram, etc. Amongst the younger generation, do they how much time do they spend on those sort of, let's say, social networks, video platforms versus watching any sort of TV, whether it be subscription or linear? And I suspect, you know, it's going to lean more towards, you know, sort of spending time on TikTok and YouTube, etc. You know, and
is that
it's a changing
world.
And I think, you know, these platforms need to adapt.
Yes. And do you think that's because the content on there is compelling for them, or they've just got completely different consumption behaviours than we have or we used to? Like, will they even notice the ads, or will they be forgiving for the ads if they're relevant? or is it the right time? I know I'm not going into the world of gaming and what happens there, but we do talk about that. It, you know, people will enjoy it if it's good and if it's relevant and if it's delivered at the right time, it's fine. But do we think we're going to see a big shift to the ad-funded models, really?
I don't think there'd be a big shift because, you know, I mean, talk to any print newspaper, they're never going to substitute the print ad revenues with online ad revenues. You know, how many people read The Guardian now versus back in the day when it was just print?
Print, yeah.
You know, it's a number. I'm going to hazard a guess and say 50 times more people. And yet, you know, they used to make money and now they don't. As I saw the numbers released the other day. So, and that's not just The Guardian, it's a lot of newspapers. You know, you need a multiple of users coming online to replicate, you know, whether it be, you know, the cost, the revenue from selling the newspaper and the ads within. So, and I think the same respect with subscriptions. I mean, how many hours of Netflix do I have to watch to be worth X amount to Netflix, you know, in terms of ad revenue, you know, versus a subscription, you know, this, I mean, I'm a subscriber to Netflix, but I must have watched in February so far no more than 5-6 hours, you know, a few episodes of Arrested Development, in case you're wondering.
solid choice.
I'm getting into it, it's quite good. And so I don't think they want to move away from a subscription model. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the same with any sort of media owner. I think if you can get people to subscribe, that's the panacea. You know, unfortunately, with the amount of available inventory for advertising, whether it be TV, social, etc., the rates are so low, you're never going to replicate a subscription model.
Yeah, and I think that's a really interesting point, and it feeds back to that, you know, potential change in consumption habits. We've seen the likes of Netflix, Amazon Prime Video, Disney Plus, they've all, in terms of their ad-funded offering, it's all been a lot lighter ad loads than we may have seen previously in terms of, you know, television-based platforms. And I think primarily the reason for that is they know that if you're on TikTok, if you're on Instagram Reels, you're scrolling down, if you get an ad experience, you can quickly change it. And I think if they've realized if they had, you know, longer ad loads like we've seen with traditional TV, people are just going to turn off and they're going to lose those viewers completely, which comes again to that point in terms of how valuable that is to the advertiser when you've got much shorter ad slots and therefore much less inventory to offer.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it also improves the proposition for advertisers. If there's not so many ads, surely, like, you know, let's use a metric that I'm in favour of, attention time, that, you know, and you've got greater share of voice,
yep,
you know, in terms of the, you know, the ad time. If you're one of two ads, rather this is one of five. And so, yeah, I can sort of see how they, you know, start off slowly and monitor it. But as I say, I suspect that they don't want to let go of the subscription model and they'll always be driving people to that.
Of course, and I think it's the value exchange, right? And what you get for that money and how they communicate that with you. Because if I take, as a Netflix subscriber myself, how they communicated the price increase, or do I want to reduce it and have ads, or do I want to pay a little bit more? And I've opted to pay a little bit more because that's just the experience that I like, and I'm not a multiple subscriber to various platforms. But then I think, and recently, Prime Video, they've got a lawsuit against them because of them just charging, in addition to, I think it was US numbers that I was looking at off the top of my head, say $139 for the Prime service. And now you've got to pay an extra $3 a month if you don't want ads on top of that.
Mm.
So I can understand that's kind of, maybe there's probably some breach in whatever contract. I doubt it. It's going to be buried somewhere, but people are trying to sue them.
You sue anyone for anything in America, right? Though, so.
There is that, potentially. I mean,
but yeah,
I wouldn't dare go there.
You know, Amazon Prime, I mean, I was a member primarily because, you know, the number of Amazon packages that used to come through the door and the free delivery that came with it, it made financial sense. So the TV service was just an added benefit. And you know, it's the usual hook them in, and then once you've got them, right?
Is the quality of inventory on there strong enough to keep you engaged?
Well, that's,
probably not.
That's the ease of moving. Mm. You know, you've got choice. And as I say, maybe.
And that's where you lose an hour and a half of your life looking through Amazon and Paramount Plus and Netflix and trying to figure out what you want to watch and then go, actually, I'm going to go to bed now.
I'm going to read a book instead.
I'm going to read a book.
What's controversial take?
Listen to a book, probably.
What's going on at TikTok? Let's go and have a look. Some stupid videos, yeah.
And that's 3 hours of your life gone.
Exactly, yeah.
Speaking of time, we've come to the end, believe it or not. That was really insightful and interesting. Thank you both, Matt. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Anne-Marie. Absolute pleasure as always.
George, thank you very much.
And thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
And listeners, that's it for another week. That's the Exchange Wire MadTech Podcasts.